Hi, everyone, and welcome to Climate Proofers, the show all about those on the front lines of adaptation finance, tech, and policy. I'm Louis Woodall, the editor of Climate Proof, and it's great to be back. Thank you, dear listeners, for indulging me in a long winter's break. The time off was wisely spent, I think, working to put Climate Proof on a firmer business footing and strategizing for the rest of the year. I'm glad to report that Climate Proof has big plans for London and New York Climate Weeks and is soon to roll out enterprise subscriptions and partnership packages for all you adaptation fanatics out there who want to get your message out to the Climate Proof audience. The packages include the option to sponsor this very podcast, so get in touch now if you want your story told in my dulcet British tones. You can reach me at louis@climateproof.news. Also, this series of Climate Proofers will be strictly limited to 8 episodes before I take another short break. Why, you ask? Because my wife and I are having a baby, and the stalk is scheduled for early May. This means I'll be taking some paternity leave for a couple of months this summer while I train the new arrival for a life of podcasting. Of course, once they're studio ready, I'll wrangle them in as a co-presenter. Kidding, of course, though I'm sure the little angel would do wonders for my ratings. So, given time is of the essence, let's get into today's episode. Today, you'll hear my interview with Kate Stein, Insurance Director for the Business Partnership Arm of the Environmental Defence Fund, or EDF. Kate has a career tailor-made for this position. She's been a journalist, an insurance broker, and even a resilience officer for the town of Surfside in Florida. She understands the climate challenges facing the insurance industry and has the communications chops to spread the word. In our chat, we dig into the so-called uninsurability crisis taking hold across America. While insurance is supposed to protect us in hard times, this safety net is fraying as the earth heats up and extreme weather events get worse throughout the US and the world. Some carriers are raising prices. Some are withdrawing coverage for certain perils in certain regions. The end result is a much more patchwork network of coverage and more vulnerable families, communities, and businesses. EDF Plus Biz is working to mitigate this uninsurability challenge by mapping insurance industry-led innovations that promote adaptation and resilience, from new insurance and risk transfer products to new pricing and incentive mechanisms. Their latest market mapping is due out later this spring, so keep a weather eye on the horizon for that. We'll get to the conversation with Kate in just a minute, but first a roundup of last week's top adaptation and resilience stories. In finance, a new survey of more than 50 global insurers shows how the industry is underprepared for climate physical risks. The poll by the MSCI Institute found only half of respondents have integrated physical risk into their overall risk management frameworks, while 22% think the insurance sector overall is not at all well prepared for the challenges these pose. Carriers also sharply diverged on impressions of their own readiness versus those of the industry as a whole. For example, while 69% of North American insurers said their own underwriting processes are somewhat well prepared, just 38% said the same of the regional industry in the round. At the same time, insurers also recognise the commercial opportunities presented by a warmer, wilder world. More than half of respondents said that underwriting for climate resilience represents a large or transformational opportunity for their own premium expansion. In policy, President Trump fired Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem on Thursday, ending a contentious tenure, which included her rocky oversight of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Trump has named Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma as her replacement, pending Senate confirmation. Noem required personal approval of every FEMA contract and grant above $100,000 and had frozen billions in disaster reimbursements, hindering the flow of capital to regions hit by climate-related catastrophes. The total backlog reached $17 billion last month, according to the New York Times, with state and local governments waiting months or years for reimbursements on relief work already completed. California Governor Gavin Newsom moved quickly after Noem's firing, demanding her former department immediately release more than $500 million in funding for recovery from the 2025 Los Angeles wildfires. And in tech, a new report by JP Morgan finds that adaptation technology is bucking the broader climate venture market contraction, with early-stage investment in climate risk modeling, weather forecasting, and ecological restoration tech persisting at similar levels last year as in 2024 and 2023. Interest in wildfire tech is particularly strong. According to the bank, 35 venture deals in wildfire mitigation software occurred in 2025 and 48 in hardware, up from 28 and 38 in 2024. Right, that's it for this week's news roundup. Now on to my conversation with Kate. Hi, Kate. Where are you calling from today and what do you do?
Hey, Louis. I am calling from New York and I am insurance director for the Environmental Defense Fund in our EDF Plus Biz unit, which is our business partnerships unit.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I've had a lot of interactions with EDF over the last couple of years. Your group has put out some very useful and thought-provoking research on climate risk resilience and how it intersects with the insurance market, but also with local, state, federal government. Before we get into what we want to talk about today on climate risk and insurance in particular, I'd like to start with a little intro from you. Can you tell us about your career so far and how you came to EDF?
So I started my career in Miami as a climate journalist. I worked for the National Public Radio member station there for about 2 years. And I was there at a really interesting time when a couple of things were going on. So first of all, a lot of local governments in South Florida and across the United States and around the world were starting to think about adaptation and resilience strategies as part of this international movement catalyzed by the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program. So that was going on. I was reporting on that. And then also in 2017, Hurricane Irma churned through South Florida, and I was part of the team covering that storm and several others that followed. And those experiences really opened my eyes in a very concrete way to the need for additional finance for risk mitigation. Around the same time, too, there were a few conferences in Miami where people from the insurance industry were flying in from London and Singapore and talking a big game about how they cared so much about what was happening on the ground in, you know, Broward County or Miami-Dade County, Florida. And it struck me that the insurance industry had a lot to gain from communities becoming more resilient, because when communities and homeowners and businesses on the front lines of climate risk are resilient, the insurance industry reduces its losses and damage as well. So sort of the thesis for my career became about helping connect communities on the front lines with climate risk with the insurance industry, and thinking about what kinds of solutions can we pursue that both promote risk mitigation for communities, but also increase opportunities for the insurance industry to be engaged in community resilience in a way that generates revenue for their businesses. So I spent a little time in government in South Florida. I worked for the city of Miami. I worked for the town of Surfside as their climate resilience officer. And then I moved to the UK and did my master's degree, and then worked in the insurance market in London for 3 years at one of the large brokerages in a couple of different roles. So it's been quite a zigzag journey, but I'm very lucky and grateful to have had experience in several different sectors that touch on these issues of climate risk and insurability. And here in my current role at EDF, a lot of the work that I do is focused on bringing together people from across sectors to think about how do we mitigate risk and promote insurance and risk transfer solutions that make sense for communities and policyholders and individuals, and also create business opportunities for the industry.
What's really valuable, I think, about your journey is that you do have real experience with all the different constituents, right? You've worked in the insurance industry, you've worked as a communicator, as a journalist, and then you obviously through EDF have the kind of experience working with communities and also with kind of professionals who are thinking about risk transfer in depth across the US. So I think that gives you a very valuable outlook for this work. I'd be interested to know, from when you first started deciding that you were going to make your career about insurance risk mitigation, climate risk mitigation, etc., how have you seen the insurance industry evolve from when you started to where we are now?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I feel like the insurance industry is a bit bifurcated, to be honest. I think some of the more traditional insurance institutions, your State Farms or your Allianzes or like the big players in national and international insurance markets, as well as some of the smaller ones that are specific to Florida or Louisiana, like the Gulf Coast, a lot of them, I think, realize that climate change is a risk and that they've certainly made efforts to invest in climate scientists. The insurance industry hires an incredible number of climate scientists. But I think where the industry and some of these more traditional players really struggle is with siloing. They have, you know, risk engineers on staff who are certainly capable of helping their policyholders think about how do they protect against wildfire risk or intensifying hurricanes or storm surge or what have you. And they have, you know, both traditional indemnity insurance underwriters or brokers or, you know, those folks. They have alternative risk transfer specialists who can do things with parametric insurance or catastrophe bonds. But I don't think those kind of different capabilities are linked up very well in many traditional and larger insurance organizations. And that's, I think, an interesting contrast to what I've seen over the last few years, which is kind of the growth in adaptation and resilience-focused insurance startups, both on the analytics side and on the risk mitigation side. There are organizations now that focus on helping policyholders understand their own risk at a property level and empowering them to advocate with their insurance companies on, you know, what can be done to mitigate their risk and you know, making that happen for themselves. And then there's also, of course, the growth in the actual risk transfer space, where more and more organizations are thinking about parametric insurance in particular as a solution, or they're entering the excess and surplus lines market, which we could talk more about, but basically moving away from kind of just the bread and butter vanilla, you know, indemnity insurance. They're doing it either better with better analytics and a more of a focus on linking up the risk mitigation piece, or they're looking at additional types of risk transfer as well. And I think that's an area that I find really exciting. And I think that, you know, the kind of more traditional organizations, the ones that do invest in innovation, I really applaud them for doing that, because that's a hard thing to do in an industry that's focused on producing revenue and generating returns on a quarterly basis. But I think we need a lot more of that kind of innovation happening in the mainstream insurance institutions. Otherwise, they really risk serious disruption from among the newer players that are starting to think about some of these topics differently.
Necessity is the mother of invention. That's the phrase that comes to mind whenever I hear about the insurance industry making moves to kind of accommodate the changing environment in which they're operating in. And I want to talk about all those topics you mentioned, parametric insurance, risk mitigation, but maybe it's important to take a step back and actually ask what we mean by this term uninsurability. It's a phrase that's come up more and more often in the media and even from the mouths of elected representatives. Just the other week in the New York Times, an essay was written by two senators, one Republican, one Democrat, calling uninsurability the hidden risk to the housing market. So this is a theme that's really gathering traction. But perhaps for those who aren't as familiar with the term, who maybe don't understand the extent of the challenge here, can you tell us why climate-related catastrophes seem to be having an accelerating, deleterious effect on property insurers?
So I think the reason that climate change is impacting insurers is just because it's really impacting the magnitude of the losses that they're facing. So, you know, we've seen these catastrophic wildfires in California and the exponential growth in loss and damage over the last decade. If you look at the insurance industry globally, there are some remarkable statistics about how many insured loss years we've had where it's been over $100 billion and climbing. And it's not that long, many executives think, before we get to a $200 billion loss year. So the losses are intensifying. I will say it's also worth noting that in the United States, the property and casualty insurance industry had quite a good year, made money, you know, despite these intensifying disasters. And they're forecast to have fairly good returns as well in 2025. So it's this interesting dynamic where the industry overall, even in the United States, which is where the majority of these insured losses are taking place, the industry overall is actually doing okay. But obviously, we are all very, very familiar with all the headlines about policyholders who, you know, all of a sudden can't pay for their insurance premiums because they're soaring. And that does have to do with not only the intensification of natural hazards and extreme weather risk and some of the challenges that we're seeing with what's called secondary perils beyond just, you know, your really massive hurricanes and wildfires. So all of those challenges are sort of coming to a head and really impacting policyholders first and foremost. And I think the industry so far has been able to sort of adapt or withdraw from specific markets that are particularly high risk. But then you have people who all of a sudden can't get insurance and or can't afford their insurance. And this gets back to what you were saying about unaffordability. So I think we're at a really interesting moment where, yes, climate-related catastrophes are having that deleterious effect on insurers that you mentioned. I think the trends are really concerning, particularly if you're the homeowner on the ground and you're like, I can't get affordable insurance anymore. How am I going to be able to maintain that? How am I going to be able to have that resource to recover from a disaster? That's really, really concerning. And I think in the medium term, the trends around insured losses and intensification of extreme weather risks are very, very troubling as well.
Yes, again, it comes down to the different constituencies, because sometimes climate risk is portrayed as an existential risk to insurers themselves. But what insurers themselves are doing to prevent themselves from going insolvent or prevent themselves from having to lose, you know, catastrophic amounts of revenue is by pulling out certain businesses, is by raising prices. So they're doing risk mitigation to kind of preserve themselves against climate risk, right? So that means you can have these bad loss years and increasing damage, economic and financial damage from climate shocks, but insurers can survive. But then what about the other constituency, the people who are actually live in these areas where there are growing climate shocks, they're growing in frequency, growing in severity? It's not their fault maybe initially that they bought a property in this area that was not the same risk profile 10, 20 years ago than there is now and there will be in 20 years in the future. But they do not have the same flexibility as these insurance carriers to mitigate their own risk and therefore kind of preserve their own financial resilience. So yes, it's interesting because sometimes you hear this story about uninsurability as a crisis for the insurance industry, and sometimes you hear it as a crisis for individuals who are trying to get insurance. And I think sometimes the messages get a bit blurred. Is that your experience too?
I think that's a fair point. I think it's hard to argue that this won't become a crisis for the insurance industry. And I would love to think that, you know, the insurance companies who are thinking about pulling out of vulnerable geographies or have already done so, I would love to think they're doing that and thinking about the implications for the people who cannot get insurance from them anymore. I mean, that's a huge deal. And you think about the mortgage markets that depend on that. So from a non-revenue perspective, I would love to think this is a crisis already for the industry, from a customer service perspective, et cetera. I think it's also really important that thinking about the medium term for insurance companies, if they're going to be pulling out of these huge markets like California or Florida or, you know, other vulnerable areas in other parts of the world as well, those are really big market shares that they're just ceding to most likely the government. So, you know, that's, I think, a business risk too, and one that certainly moving forward, I think the insurers who respond to that by trying to stay in place and thinking about, you know, how do we innovate in a way that benefits our policyholders while protecting our bottom line, those will be the ones who rise on top of some of these challenges.
Now, as I said, climate risks, they are accelerating in frequency and severity. The science supports that. However, there are other factors that kind of led to these billion, multi-billion dollar disasters that were seen in the US and leading to an increase in insured losses. And I want to talk about some of those factors that aren't directly climate related, but are more like social or market related. So one, of course, is property developers, where properties are being built and what's desirable for individuals who have the money, where they want to live, right? So that's one factor I'd like you to speak to. And then the other is regulation and state and local policy. Insurance in the US is state regulated. There is almost kind of a competitive market, it seems sometimes, for regulation in the US. And the way I've heard it from actuaries, from insurance professionals, and indeed from folks who are kind of in the nonprofit think tank world, it's like sometimes the regulations have been wrong. They've not allowed insurers to price risk properly. And by restricting their ability to say, hey, this is a high risk property in a wildfire zone, we have to charge you X amount, they have to either give a falsely lower premium or withdraw from the area. And there have been some reforms recently in states like California, I believe Colorado, Louisiana as well, to try and correct some of this. But there's an argument that regulation initially designed to kind of lower costs for consumers have actually created this situation of uninsurability. And that actually, if we allow insurers to price risk more openly without restrictions, that will send a valuable signal to homeowners about where they can live and where they should maybe think about moving. So on those two factors, property development and regulation, I'd be really interested in your thoughts to how that's contributing to the uninsurability crisis.
I'll take the regulation piece first, and I'm not going to speak in specifics to any particular market just because I have colleagues who are much more experts in different markets than I am. But I think in general, you know, models exist to be able to assess potentially catastrophic risk from extreme weather and risks to property. And when there are regulations that, you know, restrict how those models can be used, or maybe I think another big challenge is that regulators aren't necessarily active enough in advocating for what should be included in models. So for example, if you invest in risk mitigation measures for your property, it would be really great if your insurance company models that and prices it in to your policy. So you get a discount for the things that you have done that can demonstrably reduce your risk. That's an area where I think there's an opportunity for regulation. And then also things like the ability of insurance companies to pass on increasing reinsurance costs to consumers. That's certainly a challenge area. You know, no one wants their policies to go up, but sometimes insurers get caught between a rock and a hard place where on the one hand, losses are increasing and they're having to pay out more. On the other hand, they're also being charged more by reinsurance companies, the companies that provide them a backstop. And they aren't able in some states to pass those costs, or they haven't been able to pass those costs on to consumers. And that also creates a distortion in the market where, you know, it's maybe feels like it's not in their best business interest to leave or to stay in a particular market. And so they leave. So I think those are some challenges that regulators are addressing and are thinking about. But I think particularly on the pricing and risk mitigation, including nature-based solutions, that's a really important area for regulators to be engaged in. And then on the development side and sort of patterns of development, you're absolutely right that where development takes place really impacts what insurance markets look like in the future. And it's this interesting dichotomy where, you know, development decisions are being made on a 15, 30 or 50 year time horizon, whereas insurance contracts are priced basically year over year in the vast majority of cases. I think there's a lot of work to be done to sort of reconcile the decisions that are being made in development and zoning and planning with the future of insurability in some of these communities that are at the highest risk. And I think there would be a lot of benefits from communities on the front lines engaging with the insurance industry on things like zoning and building codes and making sure that they're aware of how the development decisions that are being made might play into insurability going forward. And vice versa, I think the insurance industry tends to be very siloed from local governments. And I think it would do well to engage with some of these, both local governments and lenders that are thinking on these longer term time horizons. You could envision things like discussions about as plans are being developed for a new property in coastal Miami Beach, for example, discussions about before ground is broken, you know, what does the future of insurability look like for this particular site? And who is going to pay if the premiums increase significantly in 5 years or 10 years time? And that's where I think there's a real need for education and for the facilitation of collaboration across these different kind of sectors and organizations that tend to be very siloed.
And do you see that as a role that you can perform with EDF? I'm familiar with groups like Insurance for Good, which is setting up a community of practice. It seems to be focused on getting all those different stakeholders you mentioned kind of together to think about these questions of insurability long term. But yeah, who are the other movers and shakers who can perform this sort of role?
I absolutely see that as a role that EDF can play. I'd also point to an organization that I helped to start before I joined EDF, which is the Climate Resilient Insurance Strategy Project, or CRISP, which is now being run by my good friend and collaborator, Greg Bloom, down in Miami. And Greg is a professional facilitator. I have been the subject matter expert in our little consortium. And, you know, the work that we did in places like Miami and Boston was really to bring together people from across sectors and co-develop sets of coordinated actions that could take place to help promote risk mitigation, but then also, you know, really develop a shared understanding of like, what are the capacity challenges that different sectors are experiencing, or what are their barriers to their decision-making? Insurance for Good is another fantastic organization that facilitates that kind of thinking and capacity building for local governments. So I think there are a handful of organizations out there that do this work. I do see EDF playing a role, but I think, you know, there's always a need for more of this sort of cross-sector education and dialogue.
Yeah, I started off as a journalist focused on financial risk. And what I love about risk is that, well, not what I love about risk, what's something interesting about risk is that it never really goes away. It just moves around, right? And so we've seen this amazing upswing in kind of niche insurers or surplus line insurers who, unlike the massive carriers like Allstate or Liberty, they kind of operate in small markets, usually high-risk markets. And they have slightly different marketing strategies and different underwriting strategies. And they've been kind of filling the gap left by the retreat of some insurers. There's also been some concerns, though, about their own financial viability. There's been some wonderful reporting by the Wall Street Journal and others on how these small niche insurers are being rated to give them a stamp of like, oh, yeah, this is a high quality company. And then a big shock comes through, a hurricane through Florida, for example, and then all these companies go into default because they actually don't have enough reserves to pay out the claims that they've written. So there's a real question about these new players, these kind of cowboys. Are they cowboys or are they legitimate business interests? I'm interested in your thoughts on the surplus line insurance boom and what that means for risk and resilience in the States.
Yeah, you raised some really good points. Without commenting on any specific companies, I think it's maybe a bit of a mix. So on the one hand, I think there are a lot of companies where, to your point, you know, capitalization is maybe a problem, or they do great in boom years. And if there's a catastrophic hurricane, then bye-bye. That's definitely something we've seen in places like Florida and Louisiana in the past. On the other hand, I think there's a really important role that some of these surplus lines carriers or MGAs and other kind of more niche organizations play in the ecosystem, because they are thinking differently about risk and they are making it their business model to access less traditional capacity for communities and policyholders and businesses that just can't get affordable insurance in more traditional markets anymore. So, you know, I think a lot will play out in the next sort of 2 to 5 years, maybe, as far as which companies survive and which ones, you know, unfortunately don't make it. But at the moment, I'm very supportive of this kind of innovation happening because I think it's just so needed to ensure that people, because that's what it's about, ensuring that people have the ability to recover after disasters. And right now that is very challenged in the United States and beyond.
Yeah, the way it's been put to me is that in some high risk areas in California, Colorado, Florida, like if you take a very coarse view of the risk, then yes, if you're a big player, a national insurer, you can say, look, it's not worth our time and effort to try and weed out what is insurable or not in this big zone of wildfire risk or flood risk. So we're not going to do it. And that allows these smaller entities to come in. And that's why they are clamoring for better, like, wildfire modeling, flood models. That's why you're seeing all these insurtech companies springing up and coming to events in Vegas and New York and London to tout their wares, because they realize that if we can provide these small insurers like really good quality modeling, really good forecasting, they can choose within a town, within a street even, like which properties they believe are insurable. They're still risky, but they're not as high risk as another property that might be surrounded by trees and no defensible space around them and would get swept away in the first wildfire. So that seems to be the focus there. But one concern I have, and it comes to mind when I talk about a lot of these issues of risk and resilience, is that we could have some inequality again in provision of good quality insurance. Because yes, a lot of these areas where actually climate risks are escalating in the US are very desirable areas on the coast or in parts of great natural beauty, and they might be richer householders who might be able to afford the higher insurance costs that might come from some of these niche insurers. And then other people who might have lived in an area for years and suddenly in the real world of their own, their areas become high risk. They have to move out because they can't pay the higher premium. So I'm very focused on this idea of an inequality in kind of climate risk response and adaptation response. And I'm wondering how you think about that, about the equality of insurance provision throughout the country. And is it something we can have, or is it actually kind of a pipe dream because the risks are different wherever you are?
Oh my gosh, Louis, that's such a big question. Yeah. I mean, I think there's multiple different ways to look at the question. From a moral perspective, absolutely, I feel that, you know, people should have equal access to insurance as a critical tool for disaster recovery. And I don't mean that, you know, we just subsidize insurance in people who are living incredibly vulnerable areas. I think there does have to be consideration given to helping those people relocate and what is the insurance industry's role in that. From a business perspective, you know, I don't think the insurance industry is set up to provide equal insurance access to everyone. It is an industry where you have to pay a premium in order to be able to get coverage and get a policy. That's just sort of the way it is. So then we need to be thinking about, you know, what role does government play or what role does philanthropy play in making sure that people can access either traditional insurance markets or, you know, can we look at alternative kinds of financial resilience mechanisms for them? So things like community-based insurance or, you know, some sort of co-op model or things like that. I mean, it's a really tough question. I don't think there are any easy answers to that. And I think it also really depends on what perspective you're coming at it from. I don't think we should just, you know, give the insurance industry a pass from a moral perspective on making sure that people can access this incredibly important tool that does exist. But at the same time, I think people in philanthropy and government and NGOs do need to be sensitive to the fact that insurance companies are about producing revenue first and foremost. And that's not something that can be ignored either, because it's very hard to get executives on side if you say, we need you to do this for the common good.
Yes. Again, the interplay of kind of public and private insurance provision is a very fraught one, and coming into focus increasingly, especially under this federal administration, where there has been removal, shrinking of federal aid for proactive adaptation resilience. And we might come to that towards the end. But before we get to that, I want to ask a little bit about another relationship between insurers and another part of the financial system, banking. Because there's this question that keeps coming to me, like, when are banks going to start like modeling climate risk the same sort of finesse that insurers are? And the argument is, as well, the insurers are still there. And as a bank, I, you know, provide a mortgage for a homeowner. I know that my risk is mitigated to a degree by the insurer, right? If something happens to the house, the homeowner will get insurance, and that will mean that they're probably less likely to default on their mortgage. So I don't have to factor in that risk as much as the insurer does, who gets the first hit. So it feels like insurers are on the front line, banks are on the second line. But if this insurance market is fraying, then banks presumably have to start thinking more carefully about who they're lending to in the residential real estate market. And so I'm wondering, how do you see this insurance banking nexus, and how should banks be altering their behavior in response to the patchwork insurance market we're seeing develop?
That's a great question. I mean, that's something we're actually hoping to start a piece of research on in the next few months. I'm not a banking expert, but at a high level, a few things that I would point to. So first of all, banks do use climate models, and they do use scenario-based climate stress testing. I think it would be good if there were sort of more consideration of insurability explicitly in some of the analysis that does go on. So what happens if, you know, you're a bank with a large mortgage loan portfolio in a climate vulnerable area, and all of a sudden, you know, the bottom falls out of the insurance market? What does that mean for you? I don't think that's something that many banks model consistently, and that's a part of their analysis that I think it would be very valuable for them to include. Related to that, on the sort of analysis and modeling piece, the models that banks tend to use, again, not being an expert, but my understanding is they tend to look at longer time horizons than the catastrophe models that insurance companies use, which tend to be focused on sort of the one-year time horizon. So I think there's a really critical piece of work that needs to happen to bring banks and insurers into dialogue with each other to think about, okay, what are our different models showing? What can we learn from each other? And I think most importantly, they need to understand how each other makes decisions on the basis of these different models that work on different timescales. And then beyond sort of the risk understanding and modeling component, one thing that I think it would be, well, one area that I see of a lot of opportunity in, frankly, is actually around thinking about financing risk reduction and risk mitigation and the role that banks can play in that in addition to insurance companies. So, for example, you could envision that some analysis is done on, let's say, a company that has both, you know, some physical properties that it needs insurance policies for and maybe some loans on those particular properties. I think it would be really valuable if, in addition to like the shared modeling and scenario analysis, banks and insurers were in dialogue with each other about financing upfront risk mitigation. So if you want to put in a seawall at property, maybe the bank is able to provide some extra upfront capital for that, that the insurer prices into their premium, and that results in a savings for the customer that they can then use to pay back the bank for providing that upfront capital. So those sorts of things, I think, would be really important to explore in addition to sort of the shared understanding piece. It's actually taking it a step further and thinking about what sort of like interdisciplinary banking and insurance financial packages might be able to be offered to mitigate risk in a way that benefits both the borrower/policyholder and the bank and the insurance company.
I love that. Okay. It's a coordination challenge to a degree. And it's interesting what you said about, yeah, insurers and banks learning from each other on how they model risk. I'm in the middle of doing a piece on, are banks using catastrophe models, and if so, how? And it's a mixed picture so far. Hopefully that research will come out in a month or two. And there seem to be lots of different approaches. And again, it comes down to how pressing is this risk to us right now? And I feel like we're still waiting for like a real insurance collapse in some market and a real ramifications for a bank's mortgage book before we start seeing a very sharp shift in behavior. I might be wrong, but it does seem like the industry is more reactive than proactive right now on climate risk. That's my impression, at least.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I worry about allowing risks that could be systemic in nature to accumulate and then for something to fall apart before we do anything about it. I do think some of this is foreseeable and there are opportunities to get ahead of it. Just a little plug for brokers, insurance brokers, since I used to work at an insurance brokerage. I think they have a really interesting role to play in all of this because they are kind of at the heart of all of or of many of these different stakeholders. You know, they have their policyholders on the one hand who they're advocating for in insurance markets to get coverage. They have their relationships with the insurance companies themselves. Many of them also have banks as clients. Many of them have risk engineers, people who do risk quantification and analysis on staff. That's a particular focal point where I think there is opportunity for a lot of these sort of creative relationship-based innovations to take place. And, you know, brokers are specialists in interacting with a lot of different stakeholders and managing relationships in the market. So I'd be excited to see, and maybe would issue that as a challenge to insurance brokerages specifically, think about how to bring all these stakeholders together for the benefit of your client.
Now, I want to talk about innovative risk transfer and risk mitigation measures that could be taken? You mentioned a few earlier on, and community insurance is one that comes up a lot. So I'd really like to kind of drill down on that and ask what that actually means. Who's paying for what? How do you administer that? But also any other like interesting risk transfer plays you think are worth scaling? And then examples or thoughts about the sort of relationships you just mentioned in terms of banks and or insurers incentivizing mitigation upgrades in people's homes.
Well, let me start with community scale risk mitigation and risk transfer measures. I think a lot of what we've seen around sort of community-based risk transfer tends to take the form of an entity, like a nonprofit entity, or in the case of Miami-Dade County, the Miami Foundation, going out to the insurance market and putting some philanthropic capital toward procuring an insurance policy for a set of its stakeholders. So the actual holder of the insurance policy tends to be this nonprofit organization that has the capital available to pay for the policy, and then it can distribute it to its stakeholders or its beneficiaries in times of crisis. I think that's a promising model. I think the question is always, how do we pay for the premium? You know, because it is very dependent on philanthropy. And I think a big challenge with insurance is that, okay, great, you go out and you get this community-based insurance policy, and then there's no event. And it can feel, particularly in the philanthropic world, like, oh, we just spent all this money and there's no demonstrable return on the investment, no story that we can tell our donors. And so I think that's an ongoing challenge. But I do think there's a lot more to be explored in the community insurability space, and in particular in conjunction with some of the sort of maybe state or regional risk mitigation and risk transfer efforts that are going on. I think that's a real area of innovation for local governments, and in particular state governments, to be looking at further. So that's one area. But I think there are a few different examples of U.S. insurers and beyond the U.S. actually, where they do provide premium discounts for specific risk mitigation measures that are taken by homeowners. Basically, what this is about is looking at, you know, how protected is a particular property against a given hazard. So let's say California wildfire, for example. If the insurer goes and they say, okay, you do not have a wooden deck on your house, you've installed vents to protect against embers, you consistently maintain protected space around the perimeter of your property so that it's not too close to trees or, you know, other flammable material. As a result of you taking all those measures, we may be able to offer you this much of a discount. I think that does happen. There are certainly examples of that. I think that's another opportunity area for the insurance industry. And one thing that would really enable more of that is research that links the benefits of different risk mitigation measures with the resulting decrease in claims and losses to the insurance company. There's great work that's been done on that by the likes of IVHS, the Insurance Institute for Building and Home Safety, which is an industry-funded nonprofit. I think there are a lot more opportunities for more work like that, particularly around nature-based solutions and thinking about, okay, you know, if a bioswale has been installed to reduce flood risk, or if there are some things that have been done at a community level, like planting mangroves at a very large scale to reduce storm surge risk, what's the benefit of that to policyholders and to insurance companies? So there's definitely some initial efforts underway. The question is sort of what research needs to take place in order to prove the return on investment for insurance companies and for their policyholders.
Yeah, it all comes back to that. Every time I have this conversation about how do you incentivize adaptation, it's like, can you quantify the financial benefit? It's like, well, we can model it using previous disasters, but also the problem is that if the adaptation works, you're not going to have any damage, so you don't know what would have been avoided. So it's all counterfactuals on counterfactuals, which is why I think community-based resilience and sort of quasi-public-private investment in resilience makes sense to me. I'm wondering, what's the role of tech here? Because it does feel like, yes, there are nature-based solutions that are very valuable. And we've spoken about technology in the form of more advanced modeling for help with identifying risk, quantifying risk. But I'm thinking actually in terms of like hard tech or other sorts of like kind of physical interventions that can actually help with risk mitigation. Any thoughts on technology's role here?
I'm unfortunately not an engineer. That is not one of the careers that I've had in my different careers. But I do think there's, like, I come at it more from a financing perspective. And like, I think there are a lot of things that can be done at the property level that, and in a lot of cases, you know, the insurance agent doesn't know that this is something that might benefit a policyholder, or the broker doesn't know that, and they're not communicating that information to them. There's challenges around getting that data to the insurance company to price it in. There's the challenges that we talked about, modeling and quantification of, and like understanding the linkages between those investments and the benefits that they provide to insurance companies. So I'm biased as a non-engineer, but I think there's a lot of sort of data sharing and communications channels that actually could be addressed maybe sooner and more easily than thinking about how do we just completely reimagine what housing looks like for an entire state. Like, first of all, let's just get things right on ensuring that people are able to invest in the measures that we do know make a difference, ensuring that those are quantified and priced into their policies, and ensuring that, you know, they're able to have the capacity to move out of areas that are too vulnerable for engineering solutions that we do know exist. So I do think there's a lot of sort of lower hanging fruit at the moment.
Yeah, I just asked the question because, again, it's so interrelated. Like, how do you know what interventions will make the biggest difference to a house or community in terms of reducing their climate vulnerability or exposure? Sometimes that can be revealed via technology. And the IBHS, which you mentioned, is a good example of new kind of building, not just building materials, but actually ways you put buildings together in a way to make them more resilient. So that's kind of a technology in itself. So I find it just interesting to mention that, because how technology can play a role in, yes, building resilience, but also providing greater tools to the insurance industry, banking industry, to price things more effectively. Okay, I want to finish now by asking a little bit more about what the role of the public sector is, state, local, and federal government, in terms of patching this gappy insurance net we have here, and maybe intervening to provide sort of backstop insurance, backstop reinsurance for the industry. There are various different models to kind of draw on. In the UK, there's Flood Re, which reinsures flood risk. Over here in the States, we have NFIP. So can I ask, yeah, what do you think the role of the public sector is, especially in terms of financing and providing insurance itself directly?
Well, just briefly on local governments, before I get to sort of national governments and national risk transfer schemes. So I think local governments are really the tip of the spear for a lot of these issues. You know, they're the ones who have to engage with community members who are saying, oh my gosh, I can't afford my insurance anymore and I need it to keep my mortgage. And so I think there's a lot of really important work that needs to be done to link the sorts of resilience strategies that I talked about at the beginning with insurability planning, as my friend Charlie Sidoti, insurer, likes to call it. You know, thinking about like how, what does the future of insurance look like in a given community, and how do the community development plans and the resilience strategies impact, hopefully for the better, the ability of a community to afford insurance. So there's that piece on the local governments, and I think there are things they can do to speak with one voice to state or regional and national governments as well. At the national level, so a few things. First of all, I think national capacity for risk reduction is really, really important. And unfortunately, in the United States right now, we are seeing that be really challenged with some of the discussions around FEMA and the Building Resilience in Communities program and some of these great grant programs that do help communities on the front lines be able to invest in solutions that bring down their overall risk. But that was never a panacea either. We can't just depend on the national government to help with risk reduction measures. And that's where I think the private sector is really important. On the risk pool piece, you bring up some good points around sort of looking at national insurance schemes and the different flavors and varieties of those and what works and what maybe works less well. I think a really interesting example to learn from is the Spanish insurer of last resort, Consorcio. They have this very diversified risk pool where I believe all homeowners and businesses in the entire country are required to purchase insurance from this program that insures against a wide variety of perils. So it's not just flood and that's it. It's flood and like wildfires and earthquakes and catastrophic volcano eruptions and all different sorts of perils for all different sorts of policyholders. And that diversification has enabled the cost of insurance to be much lower in Spain, because it's mandatory and it's something that has just such a diverse pool of people and organizations that are paying in. We saw it come through the 2024 Valencia floods really, really well, all things considered, despite the catastrophic size of that event, because Consorcio was able to build up some reserves and have this multi-peril insurance it enabled the program overall and the communities that were impacted to come through and not experience the same sorts of skyrocketing insurance prices that we've seen in other areas that have been affected by similar disasters, but that have less diversified backstops. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity for innovation, thinking about how do we make risk pools bigger and more diverse? There's a lot of great examples from emerging markets in the developing world with risk pools in the Caribbean and Southeast Asia and the Pacific and Africa, where governments have come together to purchase policies for a number of different countries at once. And if one of them is impacted, they get a payout. I could imagine, I mean, this would be very, very complicated from a regulation perspective, but you could imagine risk pools across states or across several different municipalities within a state. And I think that's an area of innovation where the private sector plays an important role too, in thinking about, okay, how do we structure this? Do we set up a captive, like a self-insurance company for several different municipalities together? So that's an opportunity of innovation that I think the insurance industry would do well to be thinking about right now.
I like that idea of captive insurers being kind of created via a syndicate of municipalities. I think that could be quite an attractive approach.
There's one of those actually in California, I will say. It's called PRISM. Yeah, so there is at least one out there.
There's some other commentator said that the US government is basically an insurance program with a military, right? And it's true that if you have the larger the risk pool, the more you can diversify costs. And that was the idea behind health insurance in nationalized health services like the UK. And it makes you wonder, yes, if you can pool risks, the broader the pool, the better, and that lowers costs for everyone. But then you have the free rider issue of like, okay, why should I be basically subsidizing someone buying a massive house in the middle of the WUI or right on the Florida coast? Why should I be providing subsidies for that? So there's all these political challenges with providing sort of public insurance, I feel. But then at a local, at a smaller level, local governments banding together, I can see that being potentially more palatable as long as the local communities are brought on board with that, for sure.
I think the point that you raise about, you know, if there is subsidization taking place, or on the flip side, if we're encouraging people to leave areas that insurance models suggest are very vulnerable, there's a lot of moral questions within that and questions that ought to be decided democratically. And that's where I think we get back to the discussion that we've been having today about dialogue and facilitating cross-sector dialogue and ensuring that the people and businesses who are most affected have a voice in these discussions.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Kate. Before I let you go, can you tell me a little about what you've got in the works for this year in terms of research projects, anything you can give us a little sneak peek into?
Oh my gosh, I love this question because I've been working on our strategy all week. So actually all year. I lead EDF's engagement with the insurance industry, not only on adaptation and resilience issues, which we've been talking about today, but also on insurance for the energy transition. And so we are doing quite a bit of work right now on thinking about what role can EDF and other partners across the ecosystem play in creating enabling conditions for the emergence of new insurance products for clean energy technologies that are early in the market. So your electrolyzers for hydrogen or your small modular reactors. We have a lot of great partners and are heading toward a pilot project in that area. So stay tuned for more on that. Within the adaptation and resilience side, I have several people who I'm working with and who are doing great work on mapping out insurance innovation for adaptation and resilience. So looking at a lot of different flavors of insurance arrangements that promote risk mitigation or harness catastrophe bonds or parametric insurance. So we'll have a report on that coming out in the next few months. And then the piece about insurance and banking, that's an area too that we are currently scoping a study for. So yeah, lots of different exciting projects underway.
Yes, that does feel like a full docket. And I do look forward to examining those outputs and catching up with EDF's thinking on these key climate risk resilience issues. As I said at the top, you provide a valuable resource. A lot of your stuff is readily available for the public. So absolutely. Keep sending them my way, Kate, and I look forward to catching up later in the year on some of these projects. For now, thank you so much for your time and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Louis.
Climate Proofers is a Climate Proof Media production. It is produced and presented by me, Louis Woodall. Subscribe to the Climate Proof newsletter by going to climateproof.news/subscribe. And to learn more about the publication, feel free to reach out directly using our LinkedIn page. Goodbye for now.